Ma deuxième personne est au fond.
Okay.
Je l'attends.
Okay.
Et on est là.
Moi aussi.
Alors, on est très heureux d'avoir vous ici pour notre invité d'honneur, David Schneider. C'est un honneur de l'avoir ici. David est quelqu'un qui est hors norme, dans le sens que il a commencé sa pratique dans la tradition zen et il a poursuivi dans la tradition de Shambhala de Shogyam Trungpa Rinpoche. Aujourd'hui, il enseigne dans cette tradition et il s'occupe des activités en Allemagne et maybe elsewhere in Europe too. Yeah. Et c'est aussi un écrivain, un biographe, qui a écrit deux biographies de deux maîtres zen hors normes. Ethan Dorsey et Philip Whalen. Je crois que ces deux livres-là n'ont pas été traduits en français. I think,
hein, non.
Le livre.
Hélas.
Quoi?
Hélas.
La biographie de Philip Whalen vient de sortir il y a peu de temps, l'année dernière, c'est ça?
Mm-hmm.
Ce soir, il va nous parler, je ne sais pas exactement ce qu'il va faire, mais le titre d'une conférence Zen et Tantra, et il va vous expliquer l'origine de ça, c'est ce livre qu'il a édité avec Judith Leaf, quelqu'un d'autre de la position de Shambhala, et on a les livres là à vendre après, si ça vous intéresse. Et je pense que David would sign them too.
Oh.
Donc, voilà, bonne soirée et thank you, David.
Thank you. Thank you for this kind introduction. And despite being surrounded by friends, friends for many years, friends from just a few years, it's a good thing that I am not claustrophobic. You have definitely the feeling here of no escape. So I will speak in English, and I tend to talk slowly. I can't think of too many things to say, so it comes out slow. I was invited to, Amy was kind enough to invite me to speak a little about this wonderful book called Zen and Tantra. In English, it has another title. It's called The Teacup and the Skull Cup. And I brought my copy and I left it where I'm staying tonight in my hurry to get here. So, but it's a very lovely book. And what I thought I would do tonight is tell you some of the history of the book and of the teachers involved in the book. So it's more, you could say, a historical talk than a Dharma talk, maybe. But when I was thinking about it, I was reflecting that most of the Zen teachings that I have read and received are basically historical stories of Zen teachers doing this or that thing, and then the Zen teacher asks you if you understand. What's the point of the story? Do you get it? So I thought, well, maybe if I tell the history, it's not so far from a Dharma talk. And maybe you'll get it. maybe you'll get the point. I will suggest a few points that occur to me, but there are more. So this book actually was born in Paris. It was the idea of a famous French Buddhist called Fabrice Midal. I'm sure you've heard of him, some of you. And he used to be a member of the Shambhala world, and he was a friend of mine. And he wrote a biography of Trungpa Rinpoche, or he assembled a biography. And he called and he said to me that in the course of his research, he had discovered these amazing teachings by Trungpa Rinpoche on Zen and Tantra, and they were not yet published. And we had to meet and talk about them. And we had to meet at the Louvre. And then he said, well, not exactly the Louvre, but there's a cafe kind of in the Louvre, onto the side, and so we'll meet there. It was important to him that we met in this specific place. So I was, okay, I had no idea. And he handed me these pages that he had gotten from the archive that exists in Halifax, Nova Scotia, where all of the papers and teachings and transcripts, tapes, movies from Trungpa Rinpoche are housed. So it's for us in Shambhala, it's a valuable collection. I think for Buddhism in the West, in general, it's a very valuable collection. And so we had this coffee and cakes, and then he handed me these pages and said, I think, you know, these should be published. So I worked as an editor for various, what's the word in French? What would you say? House or...
Maison
d'édition. But I had not at that point been an editor for Trungpa Rinpoche. In fact, he had not had a new editor in 30 years. There was a very small, tightly controlled, jealously guarded group of people who were allowed to edit his works. And I was not one of them. But they let me do it, together with another editor, a wonderful woman named Judy Leaf, who was one of the senior editors. And we had so much fun. She also had studied Zen. And this book is two seminars that Trungpa Rinpoche gave in 1973, in the winter, 72 and 73. In Vermont, freezing cold, terrible place to be in the winter, beautiful but rugged. And he gave these talks to his students. And the reason that I think, in retrospect, looking back, the reason he gave these seminars is that he had come from Tibet. He had literally walked out of Tibet, chased by the Chinese, nearly caught several times, leading a group of 300 people over the mountains and into India. And he had been the abbot of a large group of monasteries, and he was a tantric master, a Vajra master. He was a high scholar, it would be the equivalent of a doctor or doctor of divinity, I suppose. He was considered a kind of a crazy wisdom specialist. He was a lot of the Tibetans study a lot, but not many of them meditate a lot relative to the whole population, but he did. And he was famous for it. He was famous for the quality of his shamatha, the what we would call zazen, or dwelling in peace, is a literal Sanskrit translation, or abiding. He was also kind of a magical sort of fellow. He was what was known as a tertong. He was someone who could find terma, treasure. Tertons could find terma, and he was one of the ones who could do that. Things that had been buried by Padmasambhava in the 8th century around Tibet, and certain teachers were able to find these things. They could tune in somehow. They were could feel where they were. He was one of them. So he found metal things. He found a marble kind of egg in which on the inside were texts. Many kinds of terma. He also found things that were hidden. They say they can be hidden in the earth. They can be hidden in water, they can be hidden in trees, they can be hidden in space, they can be hidden in mind. Yeah, and he found several in these different places, including some that were in mind. And he ended up in the United States after some time in England. He ended up at this little farm in Vermont. And he didn't have any money. Nobody here knew who he, or nobody there knew who he was. Nobody here either. He had a 16-year-old wife that had been a bit of a scandal. And so he arrived kind of it didn't look promising, let us say, from being the head of a chain of monasteries and famous as this great master and scholar to this sort of penniless outcast child bride taker. But he was so magnetic that he soon assembled a group of students. He was very attractive in his way of teaching. And many of the people who were interested in his teaching were Zen students. So he immediately attracted a group of students who knew something about Buddhism, and the Buddhism they knew about was Zen. Many of the early and leadership students in his, what he would call the scene, were Zen students, mostly from Suzuki Roshi's lineage. And so he practiced in that way. He did a lot of just plain sitting. A lot of sitting. And talking about tantric subjects. However, he talked about Milarepa. He talked about Padmasambhava. He talked about Mahamudra. He talked about Mahaati. But what they did was they practiced Zen style. They just sat. So that was for about 2 or 3 years. And at some point, actually this point, the point of these seminars, he decided, okay, now I'm going to tell you the difference between what we have been doing, which is we've been talking about Tantra and practicing Zen. And now we're going all the way with Tantra. And here's the difference. I'm going to distinguish the two traditions. Okay? I'm going to tell you the difference. And that's what's in these two seminars. There's about four lectures in each one, and there are various other things in the book, like his commentary on the ox herding pictures. Did it make it into the French? Yeah. And his commentary on Suzuki Roshi. Various texts, Chinese texts, that were chanted in his sangha. We weren't chanting Tibetan things in those days. Not many, anyway. But it was, and you could see this later, at the time people didn't know why he was suddenly talking about this. But with a distance, you could see, okay, so he's changing the direction. He's steering in a new way. And the way that he talked about and distinguished these traditions very often was through the art. So he talks about the art of the two traditions as a way of helping understand their philosophical bases and the way those philosophical bases manifest. He also talked about the psychology. He said, you know, Zen is wild and Tantra is crazy. and yeah, we all laugh and we think that's charming. But he said, think about it. If you have a child and your child is wild, that's okay. You know they're going to grow up and maybe you can tame them. But if your child is crazy, that's different. So he was very penetrating. And I saw some early footage of his talks in those days. It's hard to believe now. Really, it's hard to believe because the students, we're talking about maybe 71 or 72, and all of the men had hair like this. What we would call the Jufro, this big hair. And they would lie on the ground and listen to him. And he would sit in the chair, and he had usually a drink, and he often smoked cigarettes while talking. Which everybody thought was just so cool. I think they were more actually attracted to how cool he was than what he was saying. Honestly speaking. Because you couldn't always understand what he was saying. So. But he was cool, that was for sure. So we finished editing this book. And Judy and I were very excited about the material in the book. It was very challenging. And it took us about a year. And we really worked hard on it, and we felt proud, and we were about ready to publish it, and she said, well, there's one thing missing, and I said, what? And she said, an introduction. I said, oh, okay. And she goes, and you're going to write it. I said, I'm going to write it, because she had usually writes the introductions to Trungpa Rinpoche's books. She goes, no, you're going to write the one to this book. So I had to write the introduction. And what I ended up talking about was five friendships, close and important friendships that Trungpa Rinpoche had with Zen teachers. Three of them, maybe four, happened before before the time of these talks. And one or two of them happened later and were less influential in these talks. So I thought maybe I could just describe that a couple of these friendships and then maybe tell you a few stories. The first friendship was with Suzuki Roshi. And that began, I think it was 1970, when Trungpa Rinpoche had just come to America, and Suzuki Roshi's book had just been published, Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. So it's difficult to believe now, but there were like almost no books by Zen teachers at that time. D.T. Suzuki's books were there, and he's kind of a Zen teacher, but not like Suzuki Roshi. So when that book came out, it was dynamite. It was so powerful, because it was really about, it wasn't about the exotic side of Zen, it was about what it felt like to try to be a practitioner. And what it felt like to try to do that in the late 1960s and early 1970s in America. Because he worked really closely with his students. And the book was taken from talks given usually on Saturday mornings to his students. So they're very personal, directed at real people who were having real problems. And Trungpa Rinpoche's students, of course, told him about this book. And he had also published a book in England called Meditation in Action. He'd published a couple books in England. And Suzuki Roshi's students had read them because there really were not many books for a practitioner. And they had told Suzuki Roshi about those books. So they knew about each other through their books. And one day, Trungpa Rinpoche's publisher, a guy called Sam Burkholz, who was the founder of Shambhala Publications, responsible for many, many important books, I think also Francisco Varela's first books, maybe Sam Burkholz published, introduced the two of them. And apparently it was like love at first sight. Trungpa Rinpoche went with his wife, and Suzuki Roshi received him at the Zen Center with his wife, and of course they had tea, and they made the usual kind of small talk. And then later, after, Trungpa Rinpoche said it was the first person he felt like his own teacher in Tibet that he'd met. And Suzuki Roshi said, he's like my spiritual son. So it's definitely like a father-son sort of feeling. And there were maybe two or three visits, actually. Not many. Suzuki Roshi died in 71. And for much of the autumn of 1971, he was in bed. So Trungpa Rinpoche maybe visited two or three times. That's all. And I got to see one time there, the visit. And I'll tell you that story later. I was sitting about where you are, looking at the two of them. So, but they recognized in one another some kind of devotion to the students, devotion to the people who were trying, for some reason, in 1970 or 71, to practice. There were a lot of other things to do in 1970 or 71. There were a lot of drugs around. There were lots of rock and roll. This was the psychedelic era was completely happening. An explosion of creativity. Some of us wish we could remember what we were doing in those days. There was, that's it, yeah. But for some reason, some people wanted to practice meditation. And these teachers were there to help them. So, like the next teacher, also connected to Suzuki Roshi, was a teacher called Koban Chino Otagawa, is his full name. He just liked to be called Koban. And he had come to help Suzuki Roshi. He had been the head of the Doan Ryo at Eheji Monastery, and he knew everything about chanting. He knew everything about how to do all the ceremonies, all the ritual, how to play the drums, do anything that connected to Zen ceremony, he knew. But he was also very shy and very humble. And you would never believe that he knew all of that. He would always pretend he didn't know anything. I remember one time at our French land center, Dechen Chiling, it's called, it's near Limoges, he was there teaching a program on calligraphy. Koban was the one who had introduced our community to Orioki style of eating with these bowls and the ritual and the chanting. He had been the one who had given us the lessons and told us what to do and so forth, the first one. And that practice continued for many years. And we were using it for this program. We were eating Orioki at lunchtime, and I remember I was in the room, and the woman who was running the lunch, she was the one who was like leading the chants and doing the clacking and timing, and Koban was sitting like in the first seat, and she saw him doing something that she thought was wrong. I guess he put some chopsticks in the wrong bowl, or maybe he did something with his spoon that she somehow thought was wrong. And so she kind of whispered to him, "No, no, you don't do it like that." I looked at her and I thought, "I'm going to kill you later. I can't kill you now, it's here in the shrine room, but later I'm going to kill you." And Koban was like, "Oh, okay." He just did what she said, you know. He was the guy that taught us. Anyway, that's who he was, you know. And he was this little guy. Very. Whenever he started to chant, however, he had the voice of like a bull elephant. He was this little guy, and he would go, and whatever room you were in, it just the sound was full, vibrating. I don't know how he did it. And there's tape of him doing it. You can still hear it. I still get goosebumps when I think of it. He and Trungpa Rinpoche were closer in age. They were about the same age. Suzuki Roshi was much older. Both of them had married younger women. Koban had a young wife, a redhead. Trungpa Rinpoche had a young blonde wife. And so, and they both had children. And they were both having problems being fathers. And so they had a lot to talk about. And Koban was also a genius calligrapher. And Trungpa Rinpoche, of course, had studied calligraphy in the Tibetan style, but he had never really worked with a brush. And so Koban had lots of brushes, and so they would spend a great deal of time doing calligraphy together. And this was, and is still to this day, a very important aspect of the Shambhala style of elegance, you could say, or art. Just like it is in the Zen world, this black and white expression, very dramatic, a few syllables, a verse, a poem. And they shared that. And they stayed friends. When Koban died in 2011, he was kind of holding what was called the wisdom chair at Naropa University in Boulder, which was the university that Trungpa Rinpoche had founded. So Koban, when Trungpa Rinpoche died, Koban took, he stepped in to fill some of the spiritual vacuum, you could say, some of the teaching responsibility. He also connected Trungpa Rinpoche to Shibata Sensei, who was the kudo master and bow maker to the Emperor of Japan, 20th in the generation of bow makers to the Emperor. And Shibata Sensei came to Shambhala and taught kudo. So it's part of, still part of what we do. Koban was a great student, but he was also a wild student. There's a story about him practicing kudo in Japan, somewhere at an ceremony. And instead of aiming for the target, he did this, and then he turned and shot his arrow into the ocean. Very dramatic. I guess he hit the target. So these were the closest friends. The next one was Maizumi Roshi. Maizumi Roshi had established a kind of base in Los Angeles and was working closely with his students as well. And he and Trungpa Rinpoche had a kind of I don't know how to say this. It was fraternal, you could say. They were like brothers. So they were close, and they were supportive, but like brothers, they were also maybe slightly competitive. So there was some kind of play between them that sometimes maybe like play between brothers does gets a little too rough. You could get your feelings hurt. So at some point that friendship became less important. I don't know exactly why they weren't talking to me about it, but it just stopped being as important. Still, Mazumi Roshi came to Naropa, he would teach, and particularly when Trungpa Rinpoche died, he also helped by leading sesshins and being a presence, being a kind of a venerable spiritual presence in a community that was suddenly bereft of its leader, suddenly without its charismatic, cool teacher. We were really lost. This book, you know, The Hazy Moon of Enlightenment was one of the books of Mazumi Roshi, I think maybe his first book of his teaching. And that's a kind of a joke, because Trungpa Rinpoche was always talking about the sun, the bright sun. And so he did a book about the hazy moon. And in fact, Koban said, yeah, he said, Tantra is like sunlight, and Zen is more like moonlight. So, you know, it's more hidden, more shadow, more hinting, and Tantra is more presented, bright, more colorful also, uses more color. Whereas Zen kind of has a more subtle way of using color and emphasizes black and white. Oh, I forgot a teacher. There was another one before Mazumi. There was one in New York called Edo. He's now called Edo Roshi. I think he's still alive. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And back then he was just called Tai-san. Tai-san. Tai Shimano Edo is his full name. But everybody just called him Tai-san. And he was young and sort of very Zen, very Japanese, and very sort of macho style. And he attracted, you know, the people who wanted that. And there was no small number. And he admired Trungpa Rinpoche. He couldn't understand how Trungpa Rinpoche could be so cool, how he could smoke cigarettes and drink alcohol and have sometimes affairs with his students, because whenever he tried to do that, he got so much in trouble. He got just killed. And apparently he tried fairly often and just it did not work out. And he could not understand how Trungpa Rinpoche could do it. It's like, you know, couldn't get it. And he didn't understand how this guy, Trungpa Rinpoche, who was sort of, he moved slowly, he talked slowly, how he could do so much. And then when Trungpa Rinpoche died, Edo Roshi came to the place in Vermont, the same little house in Vermont. By this time it's a big practice center. Now it's called Karma Chilling. It's enormous and still growing. He came and he saw everybody kind of working to create a kind of proper funeral. It took months for Trungpa Rinpoche. It had to be a certain weather. People came from Tibet for this funeral. It was a big deal. And Edo Roshi came and he saw all of these students from all over America were building and working and doing these ceremonies. And he said, now I got it. Now I see who he was. I see it in his students. He saw it in the place. And Yeah. Sometimes it happens after somebody leaves. You see who they are. It's not always, you don't always get it when they're alive. Sometimes it's later. And then one more, I think. There are a couple more, but one really important one is a man called, or teacher called, Kuang Roshi, Chinese teacher, Bill Kuang. And he has a place in Sonoma, north of San Francisco. And he was also a very close student of Suzuki Roshi. And Suzuki Roshi wanted to transmit his lineage to him. He transmitted to Baker Roshi. He transmitted to his son. And the next one was going to be to Kuang. But then he got sick and he died. And he couldn't do it. And this was so tragic and heartbreaking. And it created really sort of difficulties for Kuang Roshi. But at this point, Trungpa Rinpoche had become a real presence, and he was like a teacher to Kuang Roshi. So instead of being the spiritual son to Suzuki Roshi, he was like the spiritual father to Kuang Roshi. And he was a great help to him, a support to him emotionally, and also he would challenge him all the time in public. So Kuang Roshi did not have an easy apprenticeship, you could say. You know, like one time, and this is, I wrote this story in here, one time Trungpa Rinpoche had a vajra, like a little thunderbolt. It's a like the Greek thunderbolt, and he was rolling it in his hand like this. And Kuang Roshi sort of said, "What is that?" You know, and Trungpa Rinpoche just gave it to him. That's it. It's yours. You figure out what it is. So if you go to Sonoma Mountain Zen Center, you find that now. It's on the altar. They're still finding out what it is. There was a time, there was a meeting between Thich Nhat Hanh and Trungpa Rinpoche. Because Thich Nhat Hanh is a Zen teacher too. It's a Vietnamese Zen. And I remember the woman who set this meeting up, she was a friend of mine. And she was so angry afterwards because she had worked, you know, like for weeks to arrange this meeting, because both of them were pretty busy, and to find time in their schedule when they could actually meet. And she said, and then they got in the room together and they wouldn't say anything, because she was sitting there in the room, you know, she couldn't wait to hear all this wisdom, but they wouldn't talk. They were, you know, they would bow and they would pass the tea. And yep. She said, they didn't say a word. She was so angry. Who knows what it was for them, you know? But for her, it was a frustration. You work and work and work and then nothing. And she couldn't very well say, talk. What's she gonna do? So, I guess it's a pretty good lesson in expectation. So, I think I wanted to talk about just briefly. I think, yeah. The situation that these teachers found themselves in. Because each of them was holding a lineage and was proud of their lineage with justification. Yeah, they had good lineages. And they had earned the burden of holding a lineage. And yet, they were living and teaching in a place where there was no context for their lineage. They were isolated in this really kind of jungle of 1970s America. Yeah? There wasn't something like a culture. There was a lot of activity. As I said, the psychedelic thing was happening, but it was a rootless kind of place. There were a lot of interest, a lot of open students. But they might check out one teacher one weekend, another teacher the next weekend. If they didn't like this, they might go there. It was what Trungpa Rinpoche called the spiritual supermarket. You go up and down the aisle, you take what you want. And so they had these lineages, they had this pride, they had this practice, they had this tradition, but they were lonely. They were having actually a hard time. They had these crazy students. They weren't sure what to do. They didn't know what worked. They kept trying new things. Sometimes that would work, sometimes... So I think it's important to kind of, if we reflect on that age, you know, we think back to these teachers, we think of them as students, we just thought of them as, I guess, close to God. Something like God. We thought, they know everything. They have all the answers. They're in control. Life is easy for them. I mean, but if you look with a more mature view, you realize, no, they probably were real human beings, and they were trying as hard as they could to do what they thought they had inherited to do, to practice and then to pass it on. And I think, honestly speaking, there are parallels to today's age in which we have a very definite spiritual supermarket every time you open your phone. If you have if you show interest in one spiritual group, Mr. Google will make sure you know about a few other spiritual groups. Other groups you might like to know about. Other books you might like to read by this author. Other people who Googled this site. And, you know, we have people, I'm sitting between two of them, who have inherited lineages and are working, you know, there's a difference between France of 2017 and Japan of 1750. The cultural container, if it exists, is vastly different. So one of the analogies of how important it is to have a cultural container is they say sometimes the Dharma is like a beautiful flower. And if you want it to grow, well, you can't just hold it against a wall or a rock. You have to find the right earth. You have to soften the ground. I think a lot of us these days, we're against the wall. Our world is more like a wall than like a soft ground. And I think also for our teachers, I'm afraid that it must feel like this also. It's not like, you know, there's a big monastic system that we have that, well, if it doesn't work out here, you can go to that one, and, you know, people will move you around and find you another place to be and give you the right servants in the quarters, and it's not like that. It's kind of more like pioneer style. And I think that in that kind of environment, the example of spiritual friendship is invaluable. Not just teacher to teacher, but all of us, student to student, teacher to teacher, teacher to student, student to teacher. You know, it's no coincidence, or maybe it's a coincidence, but I think it's a meaningful coincidence that you have Maitreya Buddha on your shrine here. Maitreya is the Buddha of the future. And if you look at the Buddha, he's sitting in a chair. Yeah? And we have the same, we have one also in Cologne, in the Shambhala Center in Cologne, a Maitreya Buddha. And sometimes you even see them sitting like this. Like this. Buddha. And the root of the word Maitreya is the word Maitri, which is like, it means friendship or love. It's the support of friendship. It's the warmth of the human heart. And I think it's just so important that in the time when it's very easy to, and I feel this in myself, it's very easy to give in to aggression. There's so much aggression around. You don't need to read the newspaper to feel it, but if you read the newspaper, you can feel it even on a national level, on a political level, on an international level, and just on the street. There's just tons of aggression. And I think in that environment, if we want to soften the ground, it's Maitri. You could say kindness or love or friendship, but real friendship, you know, like you really care about somebody, so it's not just, oh, it's all fine. It's like, no, is that okay? Are you going to be all right? You know, real concern, real friendship. So to me, that's one of the lessons that I draw from looking back at how these teachers, in their lonely, brave ways, held the lineage and passed it on. Not without problem. I think all of them have had big problems. Some of them enormous. But here we are today. Continuing. It continues. I think, and so that it continues to continue, I would like to urge this practice of friendship. Yeah. And I wanted to tell you the last thing. It just, sorry for blabbling on here. Do I have time for one? Tell the story about when I was this brand new student at the Zen Center. And they announced one day that we were going to have a guest speaker that evening after dinner. And it was going to be Trungpa. They just called him Trungpa in those days. And I had read his books, and I was living in the men's dorm with all the other young students. And one of them had a tape of Trungpa Rinpoche giving a lecture. And I came in and I just heard these these few words. He was saying, we shouldn't say things aren't as bad as they seem. things are as bad as they seem. So that was the first thing I ever heard him say, and then like two nights later, there he was. And there were so many people that they had moved out of the Buddha Hall, which is where we usually heard talks by Suzuki Roshi. And they had to move it into the dining room. And by the time they both got there, Trungpa Rinpoche came in late. Suzuki Roshi was sitting in a chair. He had his legs crossed. It was like a wingback chair, like a had a big seat and English wingback chair, and he had robes. He was sitting in full lotus, and his robes were tucked under him, and he had his mudra perfect, and he looked just gorgeous, as he always did. And then this other chair, Trungpa Rinpoche was sitting there, and he was kind of like this, and he had a drink. And he was like nodding like that, you know. And I was, as I say, I was about that far because I had really wanted to see. And so I was looking at them. And, you know, I didn't know what to think. It was clear to me they were both enlightened masters. That much I knew. But I thought, well, I don't understand what this one is doing. This one, I don't understand it easier, but I could imitate it. I could pretend. Which is what I did, really, for about 5 years, was that I pretended to do Zen. And whereas Trungpa Rinpoche, he was and he said, his talk was called, apparently, it was called The Open Way. But, you know, he said, "Open way." I thought, "What? What? What did he say? What did he mean?" We couldn't understand him. And he gave this talk. It went on for about maybe 5 minutes, and then he stopped. And then he asked if there were any questions. And this one guy in the back, he was actually standing on the table. The dining room, they moved all the tables to the side, and people were, they had filled the dining room, and they were even standing on the tables. And this guy said, you drink alcohol, don't you? And Trungpa Rinpoche said, yeah. Like this, yeah? And he said, and I heard that you smoke cigarettes. And of course he took one out and lit it up and said, sure. And while he was doing this, he didn't seem like the same guy anymore. Suddenly he became like completely laser focused. And this guy said, well, you know, drinking and smoking, that's not good for you. Trungpa Rinpoche just looked at him. And the guy said, I do Kundalini Yoga. Trungpa Rinpoche said, you do Kundalini Yoga? And the guy said, yes, I do. And Trungpa Rinpoche went, and then he just started laughing. And he couldn't stop laughing. He was like crying with laughter. And this guy, you know, he kind of just crumbled. Yeah. So, he didn't say another word. He just laughed at the guy. And, you know, so if you're in the front row and you're watching, this was a pretty impressive display. So, I mean, I count this as like the, you know, one of the great spiritual highlights of my life, to see the two of them together. You know. maybe one other story about the next time that Trungpa Rinpoche came to visit the Zen Center. Suzuki Roshi had died. And Baker Roshi, who was my teacher at that time, and still my teacher in a way, was going to show Trungpa Rinpoche this new Buddha that we had just bought. A new Gandhara Buddha, Buddha from Gandhara. Very beautiful, very old Greek Afghanistan area was where it was made. And it was going on our main shrine, but we had to remake the shrine to fit this Buddha. And he was going to give him a tour of the Zen Center and then show Trungpa Rinpoche this Buddha. And this was around noon. I know because we had a noon ceremony every day where you would chant, and I was in this ceremony. And I came out, and I put on my zoris, and I looked up, and there was Trungpa Rinpoche. I'm like, oh, my goodness. And he did the same thing back to me. He went, oh. And then Baker Roshi came out, and he said, David, I have to take this call. Can you show Trungpa Rinpoche down to the copy room? Because that's where the Buddha was being kept until we had built this shrine. I'm going to show him the Gandhara Buddha. Can you take him down there? So this was my Zen teacher saying, yeah, please take this guy down. So I said, yeah, sure. You know, and I thought Trungpa Rinpoche was like the greatest. So I was sort of going to walk him down there. And I started to walk, and he walked very slowly. He had a limp. So he walked like this. He'd kind of be like. So, and I'm standing there, and I say, would you like to go now? And he put out his arm. He didn't say anything to me, just put out his arm. And I said, oh, and I gave him my arm. And he went like. It was like being clamped onto by a machine. Just like, it was really a heavy grip. And he leaned on me. And so we went down the hall, and then we came to the stairs. And the way the stairs worked, there were like three stairs, and then you a landing, and then like about 12 stairs. And they were cement. And there was no carpet or anything. So the first three stairs went great. No problem. And we went around the landing, and we came to the top of like the 12 stairs. And so the railing is here, Trungpa Rinpoche is here, and I'm here. And on the first step, he threw himself onto me. Just completely, all his weight onto me. I wasn't expecting it. But I was young and relatively strong, and I was like, and then I pushed him back. I look at him like, what are you doing? He pretended like nothing happened. And we went a couple steps, and then he did it again. He just threw himself at me to see if I was awake, if I was paying attention. And I would push him back into the banister, and he would throw himself on. We went down the stairs like that. I was so glad when we got to the bottom. You know, and then we had to go along this hallway to the copy room. And I have this monster on my arm, and we're going, and I thought, you know, I don't have a key to that room. I hope that Baker Roshi comes soon. So I go as slow as I can, and we finally get to this door, and I thought, okay, I'll try. You know, maybe it's open. Of course, it was not open. It was locked. And I said, I don't have a key. And he just smiled at me, and then we just stood there, nothing happening, waiting. Just stewing like vegetables in broth. Finally, Baker Roshi came. And I immediately, like, ran away. I mean, these teachers are scary. You know, they were intense. And he was willing to throw himself down some stairs to see if some kid was awake. It was a great lesson. Yeah. Okay, so that's enough, maybe. Some question? Or do you usually take a question? Mm-hmm. Question?
Could you say something? You mentioned crazy wisdom, and as part of the tantric and his teaching, and yeah. I was wondering what could you say something about his what he was saying in the face of the 1970s and the craziness which was outside, and how did he connect to that? What did he say about it?
What he said was, the term in Tibetan is wisdom crazy. So it's not like craziness comes first and then wisdom. It's like wisdom comes first. And then you let go of convention. So he was this wild sort of personality, but he was the most conservative teacher in terms of starting at the beginning and going step by step by step. There were no shortcuts with him. So he knew there was a lot of craziness, and that was different from the wisdom crazy. That was crazy, crazy. You know, and the Shambhala world is one of the only other Tibetan groups where we sit like we do in Zen. We do sitting because Trungpa Rinpoche wanted to start with sitting. He saw that it worked for us Westerners. In Tibet they don't sit much. You go in and you start chanting. You do sadhanas, you do visualization. If you do years of that, it has the same effect, you know. But we sit, we do also walking meditation in Shambhala. Most Tibetan groups don't do that. They do sadhana, they do puja. So he felt we should have a very methodical step-by-step path in the face of all this craziness. And he did things like, he said, now we're going to wear suits. And these hippie students, they said, what? Suits? He said, mm-hmm. And tie. It was like, what? No. He said, and you cut your hair. And he was like, it wasn't just to torment them. It was like, I want you to be grown-ups. I need help. I need people who can go talk to bankers. Talk to lawyers. We need property. We have to be part of the real world. We can't just be on our spiritual cloud. So grow up. That's what he did. It was terribly shocking. And then when he said, now you're going to eat with Orioki, we're like, what? No!
Yeah. What was his lineage?
He inherited two lineages, Kagyu and Nyingma. And so we had teachings from both.
And was his ten in the Western world by his master, or was it just because he could stay in India when he He could have stayed in India.
Yeah, he was, the Dalai Lama appointed him to be the head of this school for Indian boys, it was called, I think, and he was the head of it. But then he got a Spalding Fellowship to Oxford. And as this young, brilliant Tibetan, if you get some kind of scholarship like that, it's an opportunity to go. He was curious. I thought, why did all these teachers end up in the West? What was their karmic thing? Why did Suzuki Roshi come? Why did Suzuki Roshi come to the West? It's like a why did Maizumi Roshi come? Yeah.
I don't know, but Tibetan has been sent by 16 Karmapa.
Some of them have. Trungpa Rinpoche wasn't. He invited the Karmapa to come later. He put on a tour for the Karmapa of all many spiritual centers. Those were amazing events.
In the Tibetan tradition, you have other masters who are interested like this in Zen, or only Shogyam Trungpa Rinpoche?
You know, historically speaking, many centuries ago, in this part of Tibet or China, which is kind of both a disputed part, Chinese say it's China, Tibetans say it's Tibet, there were teachers who held lineages that one would develop into Zen and one would develop into, you could say, a Vajrayana lineage. And at one point, there was this famous debate at Lhasa between the two approaches. Each side said they won. So there is a commonality, an old root that has to do with mind transmission, and through the practice of meditation, so outside scripture, that you find in both traditions. Even though the Zen people used scripture for a while, I mean Bodhidharma did, and the Tibetans sometimes do, to transmit the lineage. So there are many old similarities. Now, I don't know how many modern teachers, Tibetan teachers, are looking at Zen. I mean, this was another amazing thing about Trungpa Rinpoche. He was completely open. His son, my teacher, Sakyong Nipam Rinpoche, also is close friends with Bill Kwong, for example, and has other Zen friends. But it's a completely later generation now. It's not the early wild days. So he was amazing that way. He was willing to absorb things. He held this lineage, but he was willing to, incorporate. So on the shrine, it was like the shrine was here. There were pictures. He had picture of the Karmapa, he had a picture of his teacher, he had a picture of the Nyingma lineage, and he had a picture of Suzuki Roshi on the shrine. So if you went to one of these centers, you would see the mixture right there. Yeah. He also sometimes wore robes. He thought that was fun. There are pictures in here, I think, of him wearing robes. And a rock show, yeah. I don't know where they are in this book. Oh, yeah. Let's see.
The heart of the Buddha also.
Yeah, yeah. Here he's wearing robes. You can see, the books are over there. I'm not going to pass it. Yeah, and this is, for example, this is a Zen raksu with Tibetan writing on the back. So.
Where did it come from?
Koban. Huh? And then my teacher wrote on it. The Sakyong wrote on it. So it's here, the Zen in Tantra, right here.
You met someone from Shambhala tradition who met Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche in the last moment of his life. Mm-hmm. And this guy, I don't remember his name, Tom something. He came to Poland 20 years ago, and there were some groups of this tradition.
Tomek?
Yeah.
Tomek Petrikowski?
Oh, could be.
Yeah.
No, but it was not a Polish guy.
Oh,
it was
okay.
American who came from Naropa.
Okay.
And he said something like that Chogyam Trungpa had a project, an idea to leave, to write 108 books, like in, you know, in this mandala. So, that there are always still the drawing full of papers he left.
True.
And you confirm that?
Yes.
Because I can guess that this book is in the middle of this process.
Still early in the process.
Yeah.
It's not even 20% has been.
Yeah.
It's still very. There's many, many, many talks.
How powerful is what you said about this Zen master who discovered that in the funeral of Trungpa there was, how huge was his work. It's also with this book he left as heritage.
I agree. Can you hear what she's saying? She was saying that she heard someone tell about that before he died, Trungpa Rinpoche had thought that it would be good to have his teachings collected in 108 books. And they're still working on it. And most of his teachings have not even been transcribed. They're still just in either tape, or they have at least backed up the tapes to other medium. But a lot of it is yet to come out. So, and then she was saying that the way that Edo Roshi saw Trungpa Rinpoche's greatness in his students and then the Karma Chiling, she feels that it's also visible in the books. And I agree. I'm very grateful for the books. But I think he would be grateful for you. He would be grateful that you try to practice, and also that you try to do it in the modern world without feeling like you have to run off to a mountaintop, if you could find a mountaintop these days. He thought this was incredibly brave, and that's what he meant when he talked about warrior. He didn't mean somebody making war, he meant somebody brave. And so I'm sure that he would be happy to know about you here in the, are we in the 10th? The 11th. In the 11th arrondissement in Paris, practicing. I'm sure that would make him very happy, so please keep doing it. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Okay. So there will be books over there. Thank you all for coming.
Il y aura des livres là-bas, si vous voulez. Et merci à tout le monde d'être venu.
Il y a aussi une possibilité de donner une donation pour la soirée, pour le centre. Il y a une bolle là-bas. Merci beaucoup.
Merci
aussi à Gano Roshi.
Et curieusement, Roshi et Michel connaissaient David depuis des années, des années, des années. Et c'est une circonstance très étonnante.
C'est vrai.
Thank you, David, for keeping alive this friendship between Chogyam Trungpa and Naizumi Roshi.
Yeah. Very grateful.
Here, right here,
yeah.
In the tent.
Yes.
In the 11th.
Very grateful to do it. It's an honor. Okay.